You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk to an editor from Discover Magazine who spent some time with NASA's team studying climate change flying over the glaciers of Antarctica. First, many of the industries that have seen declines in jobs and have suffered from outsourcing and automation are those that have been male-dominated. Those manufacturing and other blue-collar occupations were also traditionally unionized, which meant they were better paying than the jobs in healthcare and service sectors that employed more women. But economic realities have encouraged some men to pursue work in one of those traditionally female fields, healthcare. Alana Samuels is a staff writer at The Atlantic, where she writes about economics and issues affecting everyday Americans. Her article, "The Men Who Take Women's Jobs," is posted on the Central Time Facebook page. Alana, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you focused on the Midwest and the Rust Belt in particular. What are you seeing from men who have left or been forced out of factory-type jobs and are looking into healthcare?
Well, you hear so much about how there's this, you know, big pool of men who used to work in manufacturing, and I was really curious to see what they were doing because, you know, for years there's been work showing that they haven't been going into healthcare. But I actually encountered a fair amount of men who were going into healthcare. You know, they're not necessarily going into jobs that are focused on caring or, you know, patient relations, but they're going into things that have words like tech in them, like they're becoming surgical techs or, you know, I can't think of another one off the top of my head. But
you mentioned radiation technology in your
thesis. Right, radiation technology, yeah. So kind of things that these professions that are maybe don't have the stigma of being women's jobs. They're kind of new positions or they're positions that people don't think about as being particularly feminine.
Yeah, you interviewed men in going into health professions, and there definitely is this consciousness and awareness of going from a men's workplace, I guess, a factory or a mine, into what's perceived as a women's workplace, the healthcare world.
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, you see a lot of women moving into what are traditionally men's jobs, and there really isn't that much of a stigma for women going into men's jobs. But the other way, there is still a lot of stigma, and people say, you know, even men that I talked to who were entering the field, especially nursing, say they sometimes kind of get teased or, you know, one man told me when he was in school, and they were doing OBGYN, the women having births wouldn't let the male nursing students in. They were comfortable having female nursing students, but not male. So there's certainly obstacles to making that jump, even though that's where the jobs are and that's you know, kind of the most stable field out there right now.
Yeah, you mentioned that's where the jobs are, and you focused a lot in Northern Ohio and an amazing turnaround and a change in who the top employers were. Can you talk about how that's changed in the last few decades?
Yeah, it's really fascinating. I mean, you know, I think people kind of instinctively know that manufacturing has gone away. But in Ohio in 1995, the top four employers were General Motors, Ford, Kroger, and General Electric. And now they're the Cleveland Clinic, Walmart, Kroger, and Mercy Health. So you can really see, you know, GM, which was a top employer, employed 63,000 people then. Cleveland Clinic employs 48,000 now. That's really where the opportunities are. And, you know, economists predict that that's where the opportunities are going to continue to be in the future. So it's a smart play to get into healthcare if you don't listen to kind of the people saying that healthcare is just for women.
It's not necessarily an easy transition, though, is it? For people who have gone into factory work, their education, their training doesn't necessarily match up with what they would go into in the health world.
Yeah, I think that's part of the problem. A lot of people who were in manufacturing maybe just got jobs out of high school and don't have any further training. And a lot of the healthcare jobs, especially nursing, but a fair amount of them require science and math knowledge. And, you know, a lot of times people, especially older people, don't want to go back to school to relearn what they see as kind of rudimentary skills. They'd rather just kind of keep doing the job that they were doing. The problem in a lot of regions is that there are no more of those jobs available. So it's either, you know, make the transition or be unemployed.
Looking at what these jobs pay, obviously some jobs in the healthcare world pay pretty well, but there are a lot of jobs we hear about here in Wisconsin, like personal care work, that are not paid very well. What do these men going out of factory work find when it comes to compensation in these health fields?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, a lot of these jobs are not very well paying, nurses, aides, for instance. But a lot of times you see men going into the slightly better jobs, you know, like surgical technologists, for instance. I believe that pays decently, about $21 an hour. But, you know, interestingly, there's been work on what happens to men who do go into healthcare, and they do tend to, ironically, get paid higher than women. So, you know, there are definite advantages for going into healthcare. I think one of the reasons that men have avoided some of these jobs is because they aren't very well paid. You know, people who made a lot of money and working in manufacturing don't want to go do a $12 an hour job. It just doesn't seem worth their time. And so I think one of the ways to get more men into healthcare is to maybe raise the pay of some of these jobs.
We're talking to Alana Samuels from The Atlantic, talking about men, working-class white men in particular, going into health professions a little more over time. And Alana, you talked, as I mentioned, to some men. Can you give us a couple stories of how they made this decision to go into healthcare?
Sure. So one of the most interesting guys I talked to was a guy named Marshall Wayne Wilburn, and he was working. He had kind of done a bunch of things out of high school. And eventually went to work in manufacturing at a cabinet maker and, you know, rose up in that field, eventually made $45,000 a year. And then an outside company came in and bought the cabinet maker and started making these changes and kind of, you know, laying a few people off, kind of just changing how they did business. And he kind of started saying, well, this isn't a very stable job. So he made the choice. He said, this isn't going to be around forever. And he decided to go back and went to nursing school. You know, went to school full time and worked at the same time. And now he's a vascular nurse, which means he puts IVs in patients. And, you know, he said the factory he used to work at is no longer around. So that was a really smart move. I mean, other men maybe didn't think as far ahead, but they took advantage of kind of their circumstances. I talked to another man who had worked in steel, and the steel mill idled, I think, about 600 workers. And he was looking around for what to do, and he thought, you know, I don't want to be working these kind of hard job, physically demanding jobs anymore. He was kind of, you know, in his 40s, and so he looked around, he picked up a community college brochure, and he saw this surgical technologist program at the local community college, and he decided to go into it. And he's the only man in his, or there are two men in his class. But he said, you know, it's a little strange to be one of the only men, but, you know, he's kind of being proactive, where a lot of the other guys who are laid off at the steel mill are still not working. So, you know, you do see men who... A lot of the men I talked to who did make this transition are men who had families and kind of said, you know, I need to support my family, whatever I can do to support my family. And it turned out that what they could do was work or go into healthcare.
Is there this kind of need in the healthcare field that can accommodate maybe an even bigger influx of men coming out of factory and mining jobs?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to say. There's certainly the need for nursing, but that's really hard for people coming out of factory jobs to go into because you do need more advanced education. But, you know, that's not to say that they can't get that advanced education. It's just a question of incentivizing more education. You know, there are also the jobs, these kind of what economists call entry-level allied healthcare jobs, which don't need as much training, and those are also booming and are projected to keep growing. So, you know, I think there's a lot of potential. I don't think we're near a point where the market is saturated.
A lot of the men you talk about, as we mentioned, the gender difference, men coming into women's jobs. You also write about a younger generation that may not be as conscious of or care as much about those distinctions.
Yeah, I mean, I think some of the younger guys I talk to who also came from kind of more traditional blue-collar backgrounds, just kind of said, you know, I wanted to have a good job that I could predict the hours, that I could spend time with my family. And, you know, a lot of the kind of traditional male jobs, like trucking, for instance, really didn't fit the bill. And so they kind of said, you know, like I spoke to one 33-year-old who had worked as a tree trimmer, and he was just kind of like, I don't want to do a job that takes this horrible toll on my body for my whole life. So he went to become a nurse. You know, he still considers himself kind of a typical man, I guess you would say. He works on cars, and he has a tattoo of an American flag on his arm, and he served in the Army Reserves. So, you know, I think for a younger generation that is also, you know, more willing to help out at home, more interested in kind of less traditional gender roles, they're open to these professions that might not traditionally be thought of as male professions.
We'll leave it there for now. Alana, thanks so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Alana Semuels is a staff writer at The Atlantic, where she writes about economics and issues affecting everyday Americans. Her article, "The Men Who Take Women's Jobs," is posted on the Central Time Facebook page. When people hear NASA, they probably think of space exploration and other planets, but NASA has teams of scientists dedicated to further studying a planet closer to home, Earth. Our next guest spent time with a team of NASA researchers flying over the bleak landscape of Antarctica to measure the decline of glaciers. Eric Betts joins us now. He's an associate editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. Eric, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, before we get into some of the science, tell us what it's like being up in the plane flying over Antarctica with this NASA team.
It's pretty incredible. I mean, you can't really get a good idea of what it's like down there until you've actually been there. But, you know, there's ice from just horizon to horizon when you're flying over these ice sheets. And you're looking down on crevasses that drop hundreds of feet below. So, I mean, the whole experience kind of feels like you're on an alien world. It's pretty fun.
And how long do these flights go? You're coming from the southern tip of South America, right?
Yeah, NASA's Operation Icebridge base is actually in Punta Arenas, which, as you said, is at the southern tip of South America, and they fly 4 hours across the ocean to get to the Antarctic continent, and then they spend about 4 hours crisscrossing glaciers, going back and forth over these mountains and across the ice, and then another 4 hours back. So it's a total of 12-hour flight every day. So it gets pretty grueling for these guys that, you know, they make these flights day after day for months on end down at the South Pole, and then they pack up and they head north, and they go to Greenland, and they go to Alaska, and they do it all over again.
Does it ever occur to you flying up there that, hey, if we had to make an emergency landing, we're in about as middle of nowhere as you're going to get on this planet?
You know, I try not to think about that too much, and the NASA team has been doing it for long enough that it wasn't too concerning for me. I know that when they first started doing these flights back in the late 90s and early 2000s, that was a major concern for them because no one had ever done anything like this before. Even today, it's rare to have, you know, this sort of a flight back and forth. So it's a little bit disconcerting, but you got to trust these pilots that are that have control over the plane. You know, one of the guys that I flew with the first day, he had just come from flying U-2 retrofitted spy planes over Africa with NASA, studying climate change there. So, you know, I figure if this guy can fly a U-2, he can probably fly a converted passenger jet okay.
Let's talk about what these flights are measuring now. What are they looking at as they fly over Antarctica?
Yes. Yeah, so, as I mentioned before, they're flying a passenger plane, and in the belly of the passenger plane, where you would normally have kind of the baggage compartment, they've turned that into an instrument bay, and they have a telescope, a small telescope that points down. They have sort of a conventional, you know, DSLR digital camera that just snaps thousands of pictures. There's a radar instrument. There's an infrared instrument that kind of takes the heat of the ice. There's a gravimeter, which measures these very weak changes in Earth's gravitational field so that over time they can kind of get a sense of you know, how things are changing down there and how much ice is shifting and melting from year to year.
And people might think NASA equals space. Why is NASA focused on studying this particular planet, Earth?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, I think when most people think about NASA, they obviously think of astronauts and they think of, you know, Hubble Space Telescope. But NASA actually has a pretty long legacy of doing this Earth research. And they really do it because they're the ones who kind of can. You know, this started very early on in their history and really accelerated in the 1980s as scientists were starting to wonder what the effect of burning fossil fuels was going to be. There was a lot of speculation early about climate change, but there was some debate as to who would get the agents, who would get sort of the contracts to do this sort of research. And, you know, they looked at the Department of Transportation, from what I understand, looked at the Department of Energy, and ultimately it fell to NASA because they had the experience with this sort of planetary exploration. And throughout the 1990s, their budget grew, and now they have a couple billion dollars a year they spend on this stuff. And they've got dozens of Earth-orbiting spacecraft that study everything from soil moisture to carbon dioxide levels and obviously ice. And then they have, in addition to that, they have ships and a fleet of aircraft, including the plane that I was on, Operation Icebridge.
And NASA does kind of comparative planetology in a way. I understand, and you write that global warming, as you understand it on Earth, we learned about it in part by studying Venus.
Yeah, that was one of the kind of shocking things that came out of some of the trips to other planets in the early days of space exploration. You know, scientists on Earth already knew about climate change for a while. It was already kind of a thought that putting carbon dioxide in the atmosphere would have this greenhouse effect. But I think there was kind of a shocking moment where we sent the Pioneer mission to Venus, and we saw this enormous greenhouse effect that was happening there that, you know, created temperatures on the surface of Venus that could melt lead. And so that caused some scientists to sort of shift their focus back home, including one of the scientists I interview in the mission, in the story this month, James Hansen, who's one of the better-known climate scientists. He was actually originally a Venus researcher and shifted to study Earth's climate based on his research.
We're talking to Eric Betts from Discover Magazine about NASA flights over Antarctica to measure the ice, to measure glaciers and other changing conditions there, and how it all fits into the global warming puzzle. Eric, what are they finding with these flights over Antarctica?
So one of the most important findings that they've had is that this region that we were flying over, called the Amundsen Sea, scientists think of it as Antarctica's weak underbelly because it's thousands of feet thick of ice, and the ground beneath this ice is actually below sea level. And so one of the things that they've been finding as they fly back and forth over these glaciers is that as they retreat back, they retreat inland, and this is kind of crazy to get your head around, but as they retreat inland, they're actually going downhill because of the way the continent is underneath the ice. And so as the warm water washes up beneath the glaciers, it melts them and pushes them back, pushes them downhill. And what the takeaway from all this is, basically, is that scientists have come to think over the last couple of years that the melting in this region is actually unstoppable. And some of these glaciers there are the size of U.S. states. We're talking very large glaciers that actually hold back inland glaciers and inland ice sheets, like the entire West Antarctic ice sheet. So these flights have actually revealed that if we don't take action on climate change, basically, we should expect to see these glaciers retreat into the ocean.
And that seems like the big difference there. If there's a glacier and ice shelf over water and that melts, it doesn't really change the water level. But in effect, it sounds like these glaciers are a plug for all the land-based glaciers. And if those start flowing in, we could see really big sea level rises.
That's right, Rob. Yeah, and, you know, one of the things that they've seen recently is that there's warmer ocean water coming up underneath these, as I said before. And, you know, usually when we think of Greenland, we think of other ice that's melting. We think of sort of the surface effect where you have, you know, hot sun beating down on it starts to melt. But this is really being caused by these warm currents that undercut the glaciers, undercut these ice sheets, and then that causes, as you said, additional ice to flow into the ocean, kind of pulling a stopper.
Is there a snowball effect here where this happens some and that leads to more, it kind of accelerates itself?
That's the fear. There's still a lot of work to be done here, and that was one of the main reasons I wanted to do this story, because some of this is really well-established science now, but the big question scientists are trying to answer is how soon is soon? You know, how quickly should we expect this melting to happen? And we really don't have a good handle on that right now. So there's some projections that look over the next couple decades, the coming decades, the next century, and they see dramatic ice melting, significant sea level rise, and there's some projections that are showing, you know, many centuries, perhaps 1,000 years, and those are less likely scenarios at this point, but there's still a lot of wiggle room there that could have major impacts for civilization in the U.S. alone, there's millions of people who live along the coast, and if we see 1 or 3 feet of sea level rise even, that would displace millions of people.
And that idea that there could be 1 or 2 feet of sea level rise, largely from these Antarctic glaciers, that seems plausible?
Yeah, well, I mean, the largest question with sea level rise is the heat that gets trapped from the greenhouse effect and causes the ocean to expand. And this is just kind of a double whammy, too, where you have the oceans are already rising, and we know that we're going to see melting around the planet from, you know, various other land glaciers from Greenland and Canada, Russia, all over the world. But these Antarctic glaciers are huge, flying over top of these things. I mean, they go as far as the eye can see. And so we start to get some of these ones completely melting. You know, like there's one called Thwaites, which is one of the scariest glaciers that scientists are really worried about right now. The National Science Foundation's gearing up with like a $25 million project. They're going to go down there and really try and study this one glacier in detail. It's about the size of Pennsylvania. And if this one were to go, it would cause 9 feet of sea level rise just itself.
Eric, working with these researchers, talking to them, do you get a sense of urgency, like this is the place we should be watching when it comes to climate change and potential sea level rise?
I think so. I think most Antarctic researchers kind of see this as ground zero for climate change and for glacial melt. This is the spot in the world where glaciers are melting fastest, and it's kind of the spot where the terrain really puts it in the crosshairs. You know, there's lots of ice in other places in Antarctica, but nowhere is it as unstable as it is in this Amundsen Sea region.
Eric, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me, Rob. I appreciate it.
That was Eric Betts, associate editor at Discover Magazine, based in Waukesha. He joined us to share his experience with NASA teams studying climate change in Antarctica. Memorial Day is often thought of as the unofficial start of summer. Today, a lot of people are barbecuing and spending time with their families. Others may be hitting annual Memorial Day sales. And of course, people are marking the occasion with parades in honor of fallen service members and visits to gravesites and memorials. Ken Davis is with us now for a look at the history of Memorial Day. He's the author of Don't Know Much About History, Everything You Need to Know About American History But Never Learned. Ken, welcome back to Central Time.
Great to be with you. Thanks for having me on this most important of American holidays.
Yeah, tell us about some of the earliest origins of what we now know as Memorial Day.
Well, it's interesting. In the last few years, there's been quite a dust-up of people claiming credit for the origin of Memorial Day. Waterloo, New York, for some reason, was considered the birthplace of Memorial Day for a long time. In fact, Lyndon Johnson went there in the 1960s to proclaim the first national holiday of Memorial Day, which up until then had been really a statewide holiday. But it's semi-officially begins in 1868 with the declaration by a fellow named John Logan, who was a Civil War general, later a Republican politician, that May 30th would be a day that we would go and decorate the graves of the fallen with fresh flowers. And hence, it was known in its earliest years as Decoration Day. And it was always on May 30th. I should point out right away that when Logan made this order and issued it, he was talking about Union soldiers. He was talking about the men who had fought to preserve the Union and to end slavery. And so from its very inception, this was a somewhat partisan and rather bitter holiday, because it continued over the divide between North and South, between Union and Confederacy, and one of the reasons that some of the Confederate states established their own Decoration Days or Memorial Days. There are references to an event in 1865 in Charleston, South Carolina,
where
the Painted Children went.
Oh, we lost you for a second there, Ken, but you're saying in Charleston in 1865. Start
yes,
over with that.
A group of emancipated children, African-American children, paraded to a graveyard that had been created to reinter the bodies of Union soldiers who had fallen in Charleston during the long fighting there during the war years. And many people mark that as the beginning of Decoration Day. But it's really the 1868 formal declaration by this general, John Logan, that is the serious and the real reason that it's set at May 30th. Later changed, of course, to a Monday holiday to create a 3-day weekend in 1971.
You mentioned that controversy over Memorial Day, originally intended to honor Union soldiers in the Civil War. And this was really emblematic, wasn't it, of attention at the time. Do we say, okay, bygones will be bygones, all make up, or do we assess blame for the war, or do we go with the Lincoln second inaugural idea of malice toward none, charity toward all? This was a long-running argument.
Well, it was a long-running argument, and obviously you see it continue today in the very, very bitter, divisive fights over the removal of some of the monuments of Confederate soldiers or heroes of the Confederacy, men like Robert E. Lee and P.D. Beauregard in New Orleans most recently. There is, in fact, another dust-up over a monument that's in a park in St. Louis, Missouri. And so this is an ongoing. We've saw it in the flag controversy in South Carolina. And, of course, Alabama recently, I think they're talking about a law in which they're saying none of these monuments can be removed. So this is not a story that's over. And it's part, I think, of the great reckoning that the country is in the midst of when it comes to the history of slavery and its impact on this country and the fact that it was the reason for the Civil War and the bitterness it left lasted for decades and still goes on today. But it's interesting when you look back, even when you see a speech by Frederick Douglass, the great escaped enslaved man who made his way to New York and eventual freedom. He gives a Memorial Day speech in 1871, and he underscores this exact argument, that this is a day to celebrate not those who fought to uphold slavery, but those who fought to defeat it. So this was quite an argument back then. What else happened separately is that as time went by, the holiday sort of was forgotten. The Civil War generation died off by the end of the 19th century. It had already become something of a picnic holiday, a summer picnic holiday, even though it was always on May 30th. The big difference is the World War I losses, which we are marking now 100 years since the United States entered what was then known as the Great War, of course only later to be called World War I. And Memorial Day or Decoration Day, whichever it was called, was really revived in the aftermath of the great losses in the trench fighting in Belgium and France, 100,000 Americans in about a year's time.
Talking to Ken Davis, he's a historian, author of Don't Know Much About History and In the Shadow of Liberty, looking at the history of Memorial Day, the sometimes controversial history. And Ken, World War I, is that where we start to see Memorial Day become this national observation instead of more something more concentrated in the North?
Absolutely. And by the way, there was, while it was concentrated in the North in terms of May 30th and Decoration Day or Memorial Day, most of the former Confederate states had their own separate Memorial Days or Decoration Days, some on different holidays, like, you know, some on Jefferson Davis's birthday or things like that. I believe 7 states still mark a separate Confederate Memorial Day. And just once again, the aftermath of the great bitterness and the great divide. If we think the country is divided today, you just really have to go back and look at the history of this period to see what real division meant in America. But you're absolutely right. With World War I came the recognition that Memorial Day should be a day to recognize not only the Civil War losses, but all those who have given service and given the ultimate sacrifice in service to the country. And that's why this holiday is so special. A lot of people think it's still about veterans or remembering anybody, but this is specifically meant to honor those who gave what Lincoln called the last full measure of devotion in the Gettysburg Address.
I want to go back to the Civil War for a moment and talk about the scope of how many people and families would have been personally affected by a death in the Civil War. Can you give us a sense of that? Because I think it's kind of hard to grasp now.
Well, it is hard to grasp for us, but some perspective is, for a long time it was talked about perhaps 600,000 mostly men, died in the 4 years of fighting. Recent estimates based on census data have pushed that up from anywhere from 750 to 800,000 people. That's well over 2% of the American population at the time. So we'd be talking today about a civil war in which there would be close to 7 million deaths. That begins to give some sense of the scope. And, of course, these people came from mostly young men, came from every town and city in the country. And that's why if you're traveling around parts of New England, or I'm sure in Wisconsin as well, every small town, no matter how small, often has that statue of the Civil War soldier right in the midst of town. And of course, Wisconsin had a notable role in the Civil War, especially at Gettysburg, as you may know. The Wisconsin Volunteers were very, very prominent in the battle at Gettysburg in 1863.
And so we talked about a resurgence of interest in this holiday, Decoration Day, the Memorial Day, after the First World War. Can you talk about the Second World War? Again, this huge event that affected people, again, in every town, I think, in the United States.
Well, that's right. And World War One was that in many respects as well, because, you know, it was 100,000 deaths, but many men came back maimed and wounded, of course. And again, the population, when you consider the population at the time, this was an extraordinary number of losses. And that is when, by the way, the Tomb of the Unknowns, as it is officially known, was first built. It was built to house the body of a soldier from the fighting in France and Belgium who had not been identified, who would then represent all those who had never been identified and lost and buried, perhaps, in those dreadful battlefields in France, Flanders Fields and the Argonne, and one after another of these epic battles that cost millions and millions of lives around Europe and the rest of the world. So it was such a terrible conflagration. Again, things start to slip for a little while, and then we get into World War II. Reminding everyone, of course, that when World War I was over, it wasn't called World War I. It was still thought to be the Great War, or perhaps optimistically, the war to end all wars. After World War II and then after Korea, two bodies were added to the Tomb of the Unknowns, one from World War II and one from the Korean War. A fourth body was included from Vietnam. Those remains were later identified and removed, so most likely because of technology and what we do now, there will never be an unidentified body again.
Ken Davis is with us now, historian and author of Don't Know Much About History, among other books, joining us for a look at the origins and history of Memorial Day. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are your thoughts about Memorial Day? How do you mark the occasion? Is there someone in your family that you're remembering today, or maybe a friend or a fallen comrade? Do you have a question about the history of the holiday? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation now about the history of Memorial Day with Ken Davis. He's a historian and the author of Don't Know Much About History. He's with us to talk about the history of Memorial Day. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about Memorial Day? How do you observe the occasion? Who are you remembering today? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go right to our callers now. We have Chris on the line with us in Toma. Chris, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you for taking my call. Yeah, I'm part of the Ho-Chunk Nation out of Black River Falls, and we celebrate Memorial Day at our powwow every year, and we raise over 100 flags for our fallen warriors.
And Chris, to tell us what that's like. That's got to be a powerful moment.
It is a very powerful moment. We honor all the veterans that are in attendance. We raise the flags at 10 o'clock in the morning, bring them down to half staff, raise them again at noon up to full staff, and then bring them down around 3 o'clock. Then we have dancing with honoring all the branches of the services, and flag songs, honor songs, and then they have a giveaway for all the veterans that are in attendance.
Chris, thank you so much for calling in and sharing that event today. Ken, a powerful moment for Native American communities who serve, as I understand it, in greater proportions than any other group in the United States.
Absolutely, and I'm reminded, of course, very famously, the Navajo Talkers of World War II, but there were also a similar group in World War I of Native Americans who were on the front lines in France and Belgium, and were used to where the Germans were listening in on the wires. So they used Native American talkers in World War I as well. One of the kind of obscure hidden history facts that I came across recently and just so fascinating. But obviously that service is especially well known for the Navajo code talkers of World War II. So thanks for the call. And this is, you know, a holiday, Rob. I should say that, you know, still we're talking about it here and a lot of people are familiar with it, but there's a great deal of misconception and misunderstanding. A lot of people obviously still see it as, you know, the kickoff summer for the weekend and the summertime and the barbecues and the mattress sales. But this is really the most solemn day on our national calendar, and it's, I think, really important to understand it and to recognize it. And of course, we don't have to go around and be somber, and we all don't have cemeteries to go to, but just to remember and reflect upon the idea of sacrifice and the fact that we are really memorializing those who made the final and the ultimate sacrifice to protect those very fundamental things that we believe in: life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness. So I think it's actually okay to say happy Memorial Day, even though it's not a happy day, because they really did sacrifice so that we could pursue happiness.
Chris, thanks for that call. We'll go next to Paul in Hiles. Paul, hi.
Hi. Just a little Civil War trivia. About 12% of the male population, about 12% of the population of Wisconsin actually served in the Civil War, over 92,000 men out of a population of roughly a million. So, and about 12% of those were either killed in action or died of disease. Wisconsin seems to, over the years, have had a very large proportion of its men involved in World War One with the 32nd Division, the World War Two again with the 32nd Division, a high number of men in Korea and in Vietnam.
Paul, thanks a lot for sharing some of those Wisconsin facts. And I know, Ken, I'm about, four blocks from Camp Randall, which was a prison for Confederate prisoners during World War II. So, I mean, anything that was a state during the Civil War has a pretty strong connection to that history.
Yeah, and I should point out also, speaking just in general about the Civil War, there's so many real connections to the Civil War to Memorial Day that Arlington itself is created out of property confiscated from the family of Robert E. Lee during the war. Lee's family, the Custises and the Custis Lee, descended from Martha Washington and some of the founding fathers of the Lees of Declaration fame. That land was confiscated during the war, first used as a Union camp, and then turned into a cemetery, and finally becoming the first national cemetery. The Lees, by the way, sued after the war and were paid and compensated for the land. But once again, this connection, and if you've been to Arlington, you know, you wander around there, you come upon the Lee House right in the middle. Mm-hmm. Once again, a reminder of how the nation was divided. Lincoln could stand at the White House and look across the river at Arlington and see Confederate flags flying early in the war. A remarkable time in our history.
Paul, thanks for that call. We're talking to Ken Davis, a historian looking at the history behind Memorial Day. We go next to Gene on the line in Madison. Gene, hi.
Hi. I'm not a veteran myself, but my grandmother was a Gold Star mother. And when my dad passed away, the Legion Hall in Darlington is named, his name is in there. I spoke with my nieces and nephews and asked them if they knew how they were named, and very few know. I wonder if he would tell that, how they're named.
how American Legion posts are named, Ken?
Yes, mm-hmm. I know, but I don't think a lot of people do know.
And are you familiar with that, Ken?
You know, this is something I'll learn today. So.
Okay, for it, Gene.
They are named by the first veteran from that town that died in World War One. This one from World War II, they used to just have two names. Now you may see three or four. The Korean War and then Vietnam.
Makes perfect sense. And
isn't it, though?
I've always wondered, and now I know. I feel so much better. I don't like to go a day without learning something, and there you go. One more connection between Memorial Day and World War One, I should mention, especially in terms of veterans, is the poppy. You still see veterans groups selling little paper poppies around. I remember in school, we waited for this day when we'd bring our quarter in and buy that poppy. It comes out of World War One, a poem written by a Canadian surgeon named John McCrae, and it begins, "In Flanders fields, the poppies blow between the crosses row by row." This is a very stark image of the poppies growing up between the crosses in a cemetery at the battlefield at Flanders. A young American woman took that image and said poppies would be the perfect thing to sell to raise money for widows and orphans, hence the connection between the poppy and World War One remembrance, and now Memorial Day remembrance.
Gene, thanks for your call and for the information. And we could take one more caller, I think. Sally with us in Milwaukee. Sally, hi.
Yes. Hi. Thank you for taking my call. And I want to say that my dad, Milton Horowitz, born in Brooklyn, New York, was born on this day, Memorial Day, in 1917. And he would be 100 if he was alive today, but he died in 2009. And John F. Kennedy also was born on this day. He would be 100 also if he was alive today. So to memorialize my dad and John F. Kennedy, who was the great, great hero, we had lucky to have him as long as we did in our country, to celebrate their lives and the great. My dad was in World War II. He served and he loved our country and he spoke well about our country. He was very proud. So
Sally, thank you so much. We're just about out of time, but remembering two World War II veterans there, Sally's dad and JFK. Ken, briefly, we're just about out of time, but yeah. a thought to leave us with on Memorial Day to help observe.
Well,
the
I think the caller's point is important, that so many today, so few, I should say, American families have someone in service. It's only about 1%. So it's all the more important for the rest of us who don't have someone in service to remember that people are still fighting and dying for us as we are still at war. And one of the important things to remember on this day, in World War II and the Civil War, lots of people went. Nowadays, very few of us go.
Ken, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you for having me on this very important day.
Ken Davis is a historian, author of Don't Know Much About History, and more recently, In the Shadow of Liberty. He joined us today to talk about the history behind Memorial Day.